thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, we're wishing you the best and hope that you're enjoying your time so far this really beautiful summer. It's been very hot all over the country. I was in several states over the last few weeks, and I just got back from the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, where we were gathering a lot of plants, which are ready to pick at this time of year. And we'll be doing that in New York this week. So if any of you are listening in today and would like to join us on Thursday, August 16th, we will be at St. Joseph's, which is sort of a rectory and a convent. They have a lot of land. They have about 126 acres of land, and that is on this Thursday, August 16th. And what's going on there is going on all over the country, which is a step in the right direction, and that is that they are setting up CSAs, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And as part of that, I've been working with CSAs all over the country, teaching the people who are working there what plants that grow wild, really just what's called weeds, can be used as food and medicine. And therefore, many of those plants are then used as a crop that can be collected and sold instead of torn out and ripped out, because that's a very foolish thing to do. All we have to do is learn to use those gifts that are around us. So that was a very exciting trip up to the Rocky Mountains. We're also having a lecture in October. That's October 21st, and that will be in New York's Chinatown. And we'll be spending the day, myself and Dr. Zamperone, we're co-hosts here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we'll be taking you on a trip to another country, even though it's right in New York, and that is in New York's Chinatown. And we'll be studying with Chinese herbalists. We'll go into an actual herbal factory where they make herbs into medicine. We'll be looking at some of the most ancient pre-symptomatic diagnostic techniques, which still are quite accurate, and that includes pulse diagnosis and tongue diagnosis, and you can join us for that. Also, on October 6th, we are co-hosting between Stony Brook Medical School, where I am a clinical instructor, along with the University of Bridgeport, Department of Health Sciences. We are co-hosting an all-day event in evidence-based integrative medicine. And it does carry 5 CEU credits if you are a professional who needs credits. And if you are not a professional and you would just like to come, it is open to the public. We are allowing 125 people to attend this event, and we are taking registration right now. And we're about half filled. So if you are interested, go to naturalnurse.com under schedules and just scroll down to October 6th. There is a link to a full description and brochure of what the day will entail, and that would be October 6th. It will be in Bridgeport, Connecticut at the University of Bridgeport, evidence-based natural therapies. And I'm sure that's something that our guest today knows a lot about, because our guest today is Dr. Robert Gelfie. And Dr. Gelfie is a medical doctor, and he received his medical degree from Loma Linda University in California, and then completed his residency in surgery at the University of Utah. Dr. Gelfie then pursued his surgical practice at the Northern California Surgical Group and is board certified in general surgery. He is an active fellow in the American College of Surgeons, as well as an active member of the Fellowship for Anti-Aging and Regenerative Medicine. And in fact, our own Dr. Zamperone will be lecturing shortly at the Regenerative Medicine Conference. Dr. Gelfie is the medical director of Body Logic MD in Sacramento and devotes his practice to treating men and women suffering from the many symptoms of hormonal imbalance, including menopause, andropause, mood swings, irritability, low libido, depression, night sweats, and fatigue. by combining a combination of bioidentical hormone therapy and customized nutrition and fitness. So he brings all of that together. So thank you so much for joining us today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Hi, this is Bob Gilfie. Can you hear me okay?
I feel you're coming in loud and clear. You're coming in loud and clear.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, you're located in Sacramento, so you're
well,
in California.
Right now, I'm in Redding, which is about 2.5 hours north of Sacramento, which is where my surgical practice is, and my anti-aging or regenerative practice is in Sacramento, and I kind of split time.
Okay, that works well. Now, you have, obviously, quite a bit of conventional training in regular, what's called mainstream medicine. And what broaden your interest to go on board with anti-aging and regenerative medicine?
Well, yeah, I'm a general surgeon. I've been a general surgeon in the emergency room and running a practice in general surgery for 21 years. And, you know, you see a lot of, you can watch the deterioration of our society. You can see it in our children, in our adults, all the way up. And I started getting more and more interested in it as I recognized there was a whole bunch of things that I wasn't treating at all with surgery. I still think surgery is extremely valuable, but there's a whole bunch of things you can't do with a knife, for example. So I started getting more interested and started going to some courses in the anti-aging field, and I really liked it. I enjoyed the idea of being of doing some things that could actually prevent problems instead of just treating them after they'd occurred. And so I said, you know, I think this is probably the way that medicine is going to be practiced in the future anyway. I don't really like the business of traditional medicine very much. I far more like the idea of people taking responsibility for their health that comes in my body logic practice much more available ways. So
that's true. So a couple things, Dr. Gelfi, that I'd like to bring up. I do this to a lot of my guests. So it's about the use of the word traditional, because I have been doing natural medicine since 1964, and I spend a lot of my time traveling around the world, living with indigenous cultures, and studying the kinds of medicine that have been done for thousands of years. And that's what we like to call as traditional medicine. Also, acupuncture would be traditional medicine. Certainly nutrition, where you're using food as medicine. And just because this is my shtick, no other reason, I like to use the word traditional medicine when we're talking about things that you might use that have thousands of years of history. And then there's plenty of excellent words for modern medicine. We can call it modern medicine, conventional medicine, allopathic medicine, and certainly I never, ever would want to not have that, because when you're talking about surgery, which is such a fabulous art, you see a child, let's say, God forbid, with a condition like a cleft lip. That's no vitamins going to fix that. You know, surgery, we need surgery, absolutely. And I think what you're doing is so excellent, because you're filling in an entire range of therapies. And I'm sure you could see that, wouldn't it be great, and even as a surgeon, if surgery could be avoided, if people were able to take life action steps and lifestyle steps that would avoid a future surgery. Yet once you need it, there is nothing more life-saving. So all of it is good.
I agree. You know, what I've noticed is in the last 3 or 4 years since I've been practicing in my other practice, I've turned away dozens and dozens of people for surgery I basically just had to tell them that their problem wasn't going to be solved surgically, that it was going to be solved nutritionally, and that anybody could operate on them, but it wasn't going to make them better. And I see a lot of GI problems, and so a lot of those problems, as you know, aren't structural. Some of them are structural, and the structural ones need to be fixed. But the ones that are functional, the ones that are diet related, and there's a lot of those, and they get referred to my office because no one really knows how to fix them, to my surgical practice. This is not my body logic practice, and I end up having a discussion with those patients about changing the way they eat, looking at food differently, and usually you can avoid surgery in patients that don't have a structural problem. Surgery is great for structural things, and it's horrible for things that aren't.
But see, that's so fascinating to me because it's exactly what I always prayed would happen. Because I'll tell you, I got into this field because I fell off a horse and had a very, very severe back injury. And then I was referred to a surgeon who said, we must schedule surgery or you'll probably never walk again. But we can't do it yet because there was too much inflammation right after the severe traumatic event. So come back in, I forget how long it was, a long time ago, maybe 3 weeks, and then we'll see how you're doing. And during that period of time, I started doing all kinds of natural therapies, like using horsetail grass, which is high in silica, using Edgar Cayce packs that was soothing and increased circulation, using herbs for inflammation such as ginger. And I just found out about all of these things at the library and tried them, and it really seemed to help. So when I went back to the surgeon, I thought he would be very, very excited to see that he didn't have to do surgery and very excited to learn a protocol that he could share with his other patients. But when I went back in there, although I walked in instead of going in a wheelchair as I had originally, he didn't really seem at all pleased like you are, saying that you can help patients another way.
it's actually been really eye-opening for me. I mean, some of it, honestly, I was really skeptical about. Most scientists are born skeptics anyway. We are, you have to show us stuff and make us believe it. So I was skeptical about a lot of it, and I'm really I'm not a skeptic at all anymore. The practice that we have in Sacramento, our body logic practice is kind of I look at it as a global practice. We really just talk to our patients about being healthy, and there are certain things they can control. And there are certain things that they really don't have as good a control over. It's a lot harder for them, for example, to control. We do see a lot of, say, middle-aged women or middle-aged men with hormone problems. It's harder for them to control that. They can't kind of will their ovaries to make the right amount of hormones, for example. They're just not making as much. But there's a lot of things that they do have control over, a lot of them. And what we put into our body, we have complete control over that. And how much and how we exercise, we have complete control over that. And so
True. I was looking at you on your website, and it looks like you actually do a lot of these things, such as healthy eating and working out for yourself, which is a great place to start.
Well, I figure, I like working out. I came to it with that. I like running, and so I've been a runner for about 15 years. I was really out of shape when I was 35. I was working a lot, and I got really overweight, but 30 pounds more than I am now, and so I started running, and I really, really like running. So lucky for me, my whole family runs. I have four children who are 18 to 24, and they're all excellent runners. They all run marathons. They all run every single day. We just got back from Italy late last night, actually. And they all were there, and they all ran every day. And sometimes it was hard to run every day, but they all ran every day. So and I came from actually my diet is my least good thing that I do. I was raised a vegetarian. I've actually never tried meat ever, and I'm 51. So
what did you say? You were raised as a vegetarian by your parents?
Correct.
That's very unusual.
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. So I've never tried it. I've never actually tried a piece of meat. And, when you go through your whole life not trying meat, people always laugh and say, well, it's probably good for you to eat some meat. And I say, it'd be just as easy for me to eat a piece of dog as it would be a piece of chicken. They're all the same to me. There's no difference. They're all, psychologically, however you want to look at it, I don't want to eat meat. And so I have a harder time. Getting enough protein is hard for me, so I have to work at that.
Well, we all have our personal challenges. What an interesting life story. Now, if your parents were obviously vegetarian when you were little, did they also really have other aspects of healthy lifestyle as things that were important to their family?
You know, my mom was a vegetarian. My dad was not. My dad, however, was far more into. My dad is kind of like the Jack LaLanne of. He's 72. When he was 70, he did 700 crunches in 70 minutes, and when he was 60, he did 600 push-ups in 60 minutes. And he's one of those guys that has always been in good shape and always really worked really hard at it. So we saw that growing up, and then my mom was a vegetarian, and so she raised four boys vegetarian, and two of us still are. The other two aren't vegetarian; they don't eat very much meat. But and then I have four children, and one of my children is vegetarian. None of them eat very much meat, but it's just, I never pushed it on them. I just, we just show them a different way of doing things.
Yeah, just by modeling. Yeah. Now, I'm so interested in, go ahead.
I don't push vegetarianism at all. If people eat chicken and fish and in my practice, I just tell them to try to stay away from a lot of red meat. And to get their protein that way, and we really teach a balanced approach to eating in terms of reduction of carbohydrates. I can't tell you how many people we take off gluten, but it's a pretty big number, and we're
isn't that amazing? Just that intervention alone gets rid of so many symptoms. It's unbelievable, and there's no downside to trying.
No, and that's what I tell people. It doesn't hurt to try. Everybody needs to lose weight. Almost everybody does. So if you just go off gluten for a month, you'll lose weight, and you'll lose 5 pounds probably, and you'll probably feel better. And if you put it back, you'll realize that you felt better without it. And so we do that with a lot of our patients. Most of our female patients, it seems like I have theories about why females seem to be so much more gluten prone, gluten allergic prone. But it seems like
Wait a minute. I'd like to hear your theory.
If you put together all the autoimmune problems have a tendency to occur in women far more than men. Whether it's lupus or Hashimoto's or all the list of autoimmune processes are predominantly female. Diseases, and I think that they start. You can usually track Hashimoto's back to when a female has a baby. They don't really have symptoms before that usually, but after that they start getting symptoms. They may not know what they are. They may not be able to put it together. But my theory is that during that 9 months, when they have a 7 pound foreign body sitting in them, their immune system gets stimulated because they're in some ways kind of fighting off a foreign body, and so that hyperstimulation of your immune system, now we have wheat-filled products where the gluten is far more allergenic and available, and they start making more antibodies to the gluten, which cross-reacts with their thyroid and with their brain and with their joints. I mean, I don't know how many women do you see whose joint pain goes away when you take them off gluten?
Yes, I see that all the time. I'm interested in your theory, Dr. Galfi. I guess a good way to investigate it would be how about childless women? Do we actually get away from that pattern?
Right.
I know it hasn't been proven. I'm just asking you out of curiosity.
Well, I see a lot of childless women too because they're the ones that seem to have the hormone problems. But I do have a lot of them off gluten, and they do fine too. So what I've noticed, though, is that when you go back and ask them historically when they started having symptoms, they usually can trace it back to a time fairly soon after the birth of one of their children, usually their early children. And so my idea is that maybe it has something to do with their immune system being extra protective during that time or extra revved up during that time. I don't even know how I would prove that. And it doesn't make that much difference to me other than women seem to have better results with gluten-free eating than men do. That's been my experience.
That is a very interesting discussion, and we're going to have a little break right now, listening to a Natural Medicine Chest. And when we come back, I would love to discuss your feelings about andropause, because I think that men should have much more recognition for the fact that they also have cycles and patterns that are actually monthly and also, of course, change with age, yet they don't get that kind of recognition. So we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with our guest, Dr. Robert Gelfi.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, it should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into the Natural Medicine Chest.
Welcome once again, right back to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with your host today, Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. And you can always find out more by going to our website. That's naturalnurse.com. You can click on schedules or books to see some of the many books we have written. Or you can join us by going to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear about right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Null's network, where we bring you The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Today we have as our guest Dr. Bob Gelfi. Dr. Gelfi is dedicated to helping patients find relief from symptoms of hormone imbalance by leveraging his passion for health and fitness, as we've been hearing. And Dr. Gelfi is also a board-certified surgeon, so he brings together the best of natural medicine and Western medicine, which is truly, truly integrative. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Gelfi.
Again, a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, I have as your website and your contact, bodylogicmd.com. Once people get there, how would they find you?
Well, the BodyLogic website is a really nice website, actually. There's about 50 doctors scattered across the country in most of the major cities now who basically practice a similar type of medicine to what I do. And we all know each other, and we get together, and they try to stay very current in this. So if a person went to that website and he or she lived somewhere in my area, then there's a button to click and a little space to fill in, and then someone from the BodyLogic site calls them and tries to set up an appointment if that's what they wish to do. So we see patients from as far away as Washington State. We actually have someone from Guam in our practice, but for the most part, we're based out of Northern California.
So that website is BodyLogicMD.com.
BodyLogicMD.com, and it's actually a great company. I've had the pleasure of meeting pretty much all the doctors in that organization, and it's interesting because we come from all walks of life. There's psychiatrists, there's endocrinologists, there's anesthesiologists. There are family doctors, there's internal medicine doctors, there's ophthalmologists. I'm forgetting some specialties. There's an orthopedic surgeon. So it's not, you'd think that maybe it would be more internal medicine docs or whatever, but it's really a variety of people who kind of found this field to be interesting. And we get together frequently, and we stay very current, and we take care of really across the country fairly typical patients. That is, we see a lot of middle-aged patients, both men and women. And I know you want to talk about andropause.
I would love to, because you know you use that word, and that word is not always used. So, what is that?
Well, it's a little bit. You know, menopause, everybody talks about menopause, and they have for a long time, and everybody has a general idea about what types of symptoms occur and maybe what they're even caused by. But andropause is more subtle. Men don't go to the doctor, first of all. Men aren't used to having annual pap smears and mammograms, and we stay away from doctors in general. We don't really like doctors. We're afraid of doctors. We don't want to admit that we're weak or sick or having any problems. So men have a more kind of subtle introduction to getting older. I have some other theories about andropause and about even in younger people that I don't mind talking about, once again, theories. But I think that the anabolic hormones, in particular testosterone, has been lowered significantly, even if you look at age-matched men. Not just in the United States, but across the world.
Do you think that has to do with how many estrogens and xenoestrogens there are in the pesticides?
I do. I think the estrogens play a really big role in that because there's a feedback mechanism that will lower the amount of testosterone that's produced. I think it's affecting it's one of the biggest reasons why we have an obesity epidemic. It's why our young men aren't thriving like they should. They're not jumping out of their nest. They're not as aggressive. And I know that I'm generalizing, but I see lots of middle-aged patients, and I talk to them about their children. And it's interesting because the daughters of these patients are really doing well. They're 80% of valedictorians in high schools are now girls, and the girls are leaving home, being aggressive, finding their way in the world fine, but the boys in general are not. Of course, girls are having menarche at a much younger age. Our obesity epidemic is well chronicled. And I think that it's related to the xenoestrogens, and I think it's related to an overall reduction in that testosterone to estrogen ratio, which I think is really, really important. and it makes a big difference all the way through. But I think when you get that, even starting as a young boy or as a young girl, it really the effects can be really detrimental as time goes on.
So the first thing, of course, that you do is, I imagine, laboratory tests to determine estrogen and testosterone level in these patients that are having those kinds of symptoms.
We do, and we check that on basically everybody who we see.
Makes so much sense. That's great.
The way that our process works is that once a person decides he or she wants to be a patient, then we have a relatively standard set of labs that we set up, and sometimes we add some to it depending on their symptoms. And then we see the patient after they're all done, and we spend at least an hour and sometimes more than that with them talking about their symptoms and going over their findings on their laboratory studies. And really we do as much as we can to optimize three things. One is we try to optimize their hormone status. That is to say, we want to improve their status, reduce their cortisols if they're too high. Cortisols is a stress hormone, which your viewers or your listeners have probably heard that term before, but it's another hormone that you have to have just the right amount of. And if you don't have just the right amount, if you have too much or too little, you're not going to thrive very well. And so we work really hard on getting people to eat properly in order to have that have those numbers come back into the range that's healthy. And then we look at estrogen, and we look at testosterone, we look at progesterone in women, we look at thyroid, we look at several hormones in all of our patients to make sure that they're in the right ranges and are generally balanced. And usually what we find is, if you just close your eyes and you don't look at the levels and you just talk to somebody, you can usually guess pretty close what their numbers are going to be just based on what their symptoms are.
Really? So,
oh yeah.
Like what would be a mirror of a number that you might consider coming up, and then you see that you're right.
So for example, a middle-aged woman, say she's 50, and she's for the last couple of years really hasn't been feeling very well. If they're having trouble sleeping, which is a very common problem, if they're extra irritable, if they're getting more around the middle, despite really not changing the way they eat very much. Those are women who are almost always low in progesterone. And progesterone is a really important hormone that in Western medicine, to use your words, non-traditional medicine, and the newer medicine, has been completely ignored. If a woman doesn't have a uterus, it's just presumed that they don't need any progesterone, which is actually not true at all. Progesterone is a really important hormone for women for sense of well-being, for sleep, for a whole bunch of different symptoms that they have. So we can cover up the labs. If a woman tells me they can fall asleep at night but can't stay asleep, and they cry really easily, and they're extremely irritable over things that didn't used to make them irritable at all, they're almost always really low in estrogen. Excuse me, low in progesterone. And that's a real easy thing to fix. It's not difficult at all. You can get progesterone cream over the counter at any health food store. It's safe. You don't need a prescription for it.
Right, but it's so much better to have a physician like yourself actually analyze it and see where you're at. That's just amazing that, you know, it should be in regular standard practice.
It should be, but it actually, nobody knows that in standard. I mean, I'm in standard practice too. I have two separate practices, so I get to see it. And even the gynecologists, I think, would be right on that cutting edge forefront. Once a woman, if they've had a hysterectomy or they're not having periods anymore, they completely ignore progesterone. Some of them don't ignore testosterone. And what I've found, I know one of our topics is going to be pellets. I love.
Oh yeah, we're getting there. That's the next topic.
and so you know, in most middle-aged women that come in that have a constellation of maybe diminished sleep, diminished libido, low energy, round around the middle, irritable, those women usually, what you find is that their estrogen levels are still pretty good. They're not that bad. If they're hot flashing a lot, maybe their estrogen levels are a little bit low, but they're all low in testosterone and they're all low in progesterone. And what I found is that generally those women are aided a great deal in addition to eating right and exercising, which you can't ignore. I've had patients say, all I really want is hormones, but I'm not going to change the way I act. I just tell them they're in the wrong practice.
Well, I do too. I actually do.
It just isn't going to work. It's like trying to build a three-legged stool that's going to stand with one or two legs. It won't. So you have to exercise and you have to eat right. But if you do, then the rest kind of falls on me to get right in terms of the hormones. So, but in a woman, for example, like I've described, who is with those symptoms, and she's trying to eat well and she's exercising most days, those women have a tendency to do really well with a little bit of progesterone that you take at night and some testosterone, which I found usually works best when it's inserted as a little, with a little bioidentical testosterone pellet that you place right underneath the skin. And it allows me to operate on people again. So I get to actually use my surgical skills.
Well, we're going to take one more break right here, Dr. Gelfi. And when we come back, we are going to focus on pellet therapy because, to tell you the truth, that's news to me. And that's one of the reasons I love this field. If there's an ever-evolving more to know. So we will be right back right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You're listening to Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion about pellet therapy. That's P-E-L-L-E-T. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back once again right here on Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. And we're very, very happy to have on board with us today Dr. Bob Gelfi. And Dr. Gelfi has been sharing excellent information with us and his broad spectrum view, being a board certified surgeon as well as board certified fellow in anti-aging and regenerative medicine. We're going to pick up our discussion, Dr. Gelfi, because, do you know, I actually am not at all familiar with pellet therapy. So why don't you tell us what that is about?
I'd love to. For about 50 years in Europe, some hormone replacement has been done with the use of pellets. And a pellet is a small, picture like a Tic Tac, like the size of a Tic Tac, like a little bit like a grain of rice, that is very concentrated hormone. The steroidogenic hormones are easily placed in fat and are absorbed through fat. So you can place a crushed piece or a condensed piece of hormone into the subcutaneous tissue, and it's slowly absorbed over time. And certain hormones lend themselves to this more than others. So, for example, the hormones that's been used the most for the longest period of time is testosterone. And in Europe, they've been using testosterone pellets, like I said, for somewhere between 40 and 50 years. In America, that's not true. We really just started using it probably about, I'm guessing, in the last 8 to 10 years. And it has some advantages over, for example, oral medications or cream medications or shots or other ways of delivering hormones. That is, and one of the big advantages is that it's a relatively minor procedure that's done in the office. It takes about 5 minutes. And I'll kind of describe a little bit. Maybe your listeners would enjoy hearing it. The incision is very small. You can look at it as just maybe a little bit bigger than a needle, with a little numbing medicine that you put in there so they don't really feel it. And then a little device is placed underneath the skin, and a pellet is, for a woman, one pellet is placed underneath the skin, several inches down into the fat so it can't come out. And it absorbs over the course of about 3 or 4 months. That's how long the hormone will be kind of leached into the system, and the pellet's completely absorbed. It doesn't have to get taken out. It doesn't. It's only made of two different ingredients, testosterone and a little bit of cholesterol, to keep it bound. So they're bioidentical substances that are there. It's not some sort of foreign substance that the body isn't metabolizing. And what I found is that in both men and women who need testosterone therapy, they like this way better than other ways. it has a tendency to, instead of giving yourself an injection every week or giving yourself a cream every day where you get a big bump and then a lull, the pellets are a lot more steady. You get a little bit of a rise over the first month and then a very, very slow diminution over the next four months or so. So the levels stay higher longer and you don't get the rises and falls much. And people, there's not a problem with remembering your medication either. And so a lot of my patients prefer the pellet over other ways of getting, in particular, testosterone. We can also use it for estrogen, but we usually don't. In fact, I would say I give women estrogen maybe 1 in 10 times, 1 in 10 middle-aged female that I see.
Really? So you're not using estrogen therapies as much, but you might use testosterone both in men and women?
Correct. You know, testosterone is converted to estrogen with one chemical reaction. We're not that different, men and women. And so that's how women make estradiol, which is the main active estrogen in men and women, is by converting it from testosterone. So what I found is that most women will make their own estrogen fine if you give them testosterone appropriately. And that's not true for all of them. Some of them you need to give a little estrogen to, but it's my least favorite hormone to give just because of the potential risk for breast cancer. I still give it if I need to give it, and I can't get rid of a woman's hot flashes without it. I will give it, or if their levels stay low without it, then I'll give it. But I don't have to give it very often, and so I don't.
Yeah,
and, of course, in men, we have to be real careful about raising their estrogen levels when we replace their testosterone. We don't want men to have too high of estrogen levels. That is not good for them. So the pellets seem to work really well in men for not having them have too large of a rise in their estrogen levels, because you don't get a big spike.
Well, another reason to see a physician like yourself or for our listeners to go to BodyLogic MD and either find Dr. Robert Gelfi up there in California or another highly trained physician in hormone, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. I've actually seen men have elevated estrogens due to taking over-the-counter DHEA.
Yeah, and women do too sometimes. So DHEA, I don't like DHEA that much in men because of that. I think a lot of them will, and, you know, bodybuilders or athletes will try to use DHEA to produce testosterone. It just doesn't work that well in men. It isn't. It certainly works much better in women for making testosterone than it does in men. And when a man comes in with a high estrogen level or a high estradiol level, they don't feel good at all. And so we measure that in everybody, and we have ways of reducing that, of negating or at least diminishing that chemical reaction if they're making too many. There's a lot of different lifestyle changes that they can make. Reducing, you know, adiposity really helps. Chrysin helps.
Wait a minute. You're talking about losing weight, right? Not everybody understands that language. So just read
adiposity,
that.
Yeah. So one of the things that one of the places that we store the enzyme that converts testosterone to estrogen is in fat cells. Both men and women do that. That's why women who are heavier have less osteoporosis, because they're making more estrogen because they have more adiposity. But there's a whole bunch of downsides to having too much estrogen too, and in particular, there's more cancer risks. So, losing weight helps reduce the conversion of testosterone to estrogen.
Well, Dr. Gelfi, since we're talking about safety issues, what about the safety of pellet therapy?
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of downside to pellet therapy. The only big downside is if in women there's almost nothing bad that will happen, other than if there's too high a dose, they might get extra hair on their face while it's in, or if it's significantly too high a dose, sometimes they'll get acne. And so those two complications or side effects are dose related in women. It's actually more difficult to replace testosterone in men than it is in women. There are more bad things that can happen. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it's actually true. So in a man, when you replace a man's testosterone to healthy levels, you have to watch for three bad things that can happen. One,
they can have a rise in their estrogen level, which we talked about. And that's, if they do, then you have to fix that. Number two, a man, men have higher red blood cell counts than women do, and testosterone will make a red blood cell count go higher still. Now, athletes really like that because red blood cells are what carry oxygen around. And I tell my patients there's only three things you need to know to be a doctor. One is that air goes in and out. Two is that blood goes round and round. And three is that oxygen is good. Everything else is just a corollary of one of those three things.
That's great. I never heard that. I love that.
So when a red blood cell count goes up, athletes like it because they can carry more blood around. But if it gets too high, then your blood's too thick, and you can run the risk of having blood clots. So we have to follow the estrogen level. We have to follow the red blood cell count in men that we're giving testosterone to. And then the third thing that we have to follow closely is that men get prostate cancer. Women don't. Shockingly, women don't get prostate cancer. They don't have a prostate. But men can. And it's a fairly common problem. And so if a man gets prostate cancer, there's no evidence that suggests that giving him testosterone raises his rate of getting prostate cancer or his risk. But if a man happens to get prostate cancer while he's taking testosterone therapy, it might make it grow fast. And so I keep a close eye on a man's PSA level to make sure there aren't any rapid changes or rises in his PSA level. That's a prostate-specific antigen, which goes up in prostate cancer. Because if it does, then I have to get him to a urologist to stop his therapy.
Okay, so those are some of the... Now, is there any difference in possible negative effects with the pellet therapy versus using cream or an oral therapy of hormone replacement therapy?
I almost never use oral testosterone because of the potential risks for the liver. But no, the only big risk with pellets is that, let's say that you came down with a problem a month after they were put in. Let's say someone did a PSA or you discovered prostate cancer. It would take another 3 months for them to dissolve. And you can't really dig them out. It's not – in a man, for example, I told you we put one pellet in a woman. We put about anywhere from 13 to 18 in men, all through the same and little incision, but there's more of them. Men need a lot more testosterone than women do. So – you don't go in and dig them out. And so that would be the only bigger risk is if something were to happen right away, then a man's testosterone would stay high a lot. But other than that, really, I think that they're probably safer than any other way of getting testosterone. I'm fairly convinced that it is the safest way to get them. The risk of infection is extremely low, and it's a procedure that everybody tolerates pretty easily. It's not a big deal for most people. So
in general, now how fast do you see a turnaround in terms of symptoms?
In women, usually they start feeling different within a 3 or 4 days after getting a pellet. That is, their mood lightens up, they start feeling a little more energy, their libido improves. A constellation of those symptoms start improving within anywhere from, let's say, 3 to 7 days. It might be a little longer than they're starting out maybe with a level of 200, 300, whereas a healthy 25-year-old or 30-year-old man maybe has a level of 800. And it takes a little while for the pellets to get them up to that level where they start feeling better. And I shoot for young physiologic levels. I don't want it high, but I want it in the range at which humans seem to function best, which for men is around 800, 900, that level. And in women, I spend a lot less time thinking about levels in women and more thinking about symptoms.
Okay, so it's individualized, of course, per person, so that might change as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, we're all so different. There's patterns, as you know, at being you're a clinical provider as well, so you know there are patterns. And it's always nice when people fit into patterns because common things are common, and it allows you to, you know, to recognize that they're likely to get better just like other people who are in that pattern do. So, but yeah, everybody's so different. Everybody's eating patterns are different. One of the biggest things that I found in this practice is if you get the hormones just right and the person eats poorly, it won't matter. They'll still feel lousy. And so in the end, if a practitioner just works on hormones only and doesn't talk about reduction of carbohydrates and spreading out of meals and all the things that are important, a patient really doesn't get nearly as much benefit.
Right, and it's so good that you emphasize that, too, because it's about what they can do for themselves with some help from you and guidance and testing and knowledge. And still, it's really, you know, heal thyself is the bottom line. And then, of course, using the various hormones that might be appropriate for that person. And other things.
Yeah.
Are you using nutritional supplements as well as hormones?
We do. And, you know, we're... It's a funny thing because there are certain people have a certain amount of things they're going to be able to do. And you have to kind of know, for example, from a cost perspective, how much they can afford or how much they're willing to afford. So
right, because a lot of this is not covered by typical insurance. You're spending an hour with someone, and insurance will cover about an eight-minute visit by a physician.
Right. So it's not a cheap proposition. So here, the supplements that we kind of insist that everybody get on board with, we like DHA and EPA. We really think those are really good for people's brains and their inflammation and their cholesterol. We go over their cholesterol. We think a good multivitamin, vitamin D, we check everybody's level of vitamin D. Everybody's low in vitamin D. I'm sure you found that too.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We shoot for a range of between 55 and 80, and we're relatively aggressive with vitamin D just because it has so much important immune modulation and cancer reduction, and it's cheap too. It's a very inexpensive hormone.
Well, you know, I'm telling you something, Dr. Robert. You have been a wonderful guest. We're just about out of time here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. But I'd like to tell our listeners that you have been listening to Dr. Robert Gelfi. And I guess he calls himself Bob because that's how he introduced himself. And you can find out more at bodylogicmd.com. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Excellent information.
Thanks very much for having me.
And listeners, you can join us anytime by going to naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. You can send questions for our guests. If you have trouble finding them, we'll get them back to you. And until next time, and all the time, Dr. Zamperone and I hope that you stay healthy.